Yeah, thank you, Anjali, Martin, and Joe, for your great presentations. There are lots of things coming together here. You've talked about the criteria like within copyright law, and then you talked about the interests that kind of shape and justify copyright law, as well as also how the law is being interpreted and applied. And maybe we just go back to Joe's presentation and the last question, like, what is a song and what can be borrowed, and start you know, again from there. Maybe we can actually go back to the, like, where you ended, then we can kind of get it together at the Blurred Lines case, because this is also the title of the panel. Maybe Joe, you wanna, like, from your perspective, quickly talk about that case, and then from there we can
discussion. As I think I stated at the start, my bias is a musical one. I look at everything just from the perspective of the sound of the track and the notes that can be analysed, because that's often the context in which I engage with these kind of events. So to me, Blurred Lines sent shockwaves through creative communities. We have 4,500 students studying our Bachelor of Music at Berklee in Boston, and they're nearly all songwriters. And there was a time, well, before Blurred Lines, most songwriters had a kind of an unwritten understanding of how, where the threshold was for what could be copied, what was appropriation, what was transformative. And put in simple musical terms, don't copy the melody, don't copy the lyric, but anything else is kind of okay. And that's really how genres evolved. And the challenge of Blurred Lines on a specific and musical level is that the melodies are not the same, the lyrics are not the same, but the records do sound the same when you play them back to back. Until Blurred Lines, everybody thought those things were not protected by copyright because, for example, both Got to Give It Up and Blurred Lines have a cowbell in the background, cowbell, rhythmic cowbell. They play different rhythmic parts, but they're the same instrument. Both of them have a male falsetto voice. Both of them have crowd sounds in the background. And what the plaintiff's musicologist argued in that case is that those things in combination are themselves compositional decisions and therefore could be protected by copyright. It does, for me, come back to this distinction between what do we mean by a sound recording and what do we mean by a composition, and where is the dividing line between the two?
So, I think the evolution of copyright infringement case law, and I think this is a global trend, has gone in the wrong direction by focusing on what has been taken. So the focus, and you say this is always the first, you know, the first question to ask. First, you know, is there a causal connection? You know, and then secondly, you know, what has been taken, but from a creative perspective, you know, you would have to start with the question, what has been done with it? So the incentives at the moment are stacked in a way that sound alikes are fine. You know, you get very clever people who make something which is, you know, close to copyright infringement, but not. And that's fine. We encourage them to do it. But we don't allow to quote, we don't allow to make overt references, and we don't allow to, you know, transform, essentially. And I think there's, you know, some courts who have started to see that there's an issue with, you know, the freedom of the arts, and that there may be some more fundamental approaches how you can correct some of these issues, and that we have to treat sound recordings the same way we have to treat musical compositions. They're not different things from a, you know, from a creative perspective. If I want to express something in an artistic context, you know, it doesn't make any difference whether it's a sound recording a composition. I think the Kraftwerk case, which will be discussed, I think, tomorrow, is a good example where in the European context, you know, there will be movement. There will be movement in the right direction. But still, this underlying kind of presumption that, you know, and you say that's what your clients, you know, want of you, you know, this boxes thinking in the wrong direction, and it's hard to get out of that. It's hard to get out of that. So if one have, you know, if I would say if we start with different set of principles, they would be. As I pointed out in the 19th century, you know, is there substitution? You know, is there direct economic competition? So that kind of thinking has to come much earlier than right in the end when you think about a fair use defense. And also, you know, are you revealing the sources? So if the incentives are to hide your sources, that's bad. I think in an open society, in an information society, you should reveal your sources. So we should. That would be the second kind of approach I would take. I would shape the law in a way which encourages to reveal your sources rather than hide them.
So it sounds like we're talking about, at a broad level, the difference between what the law is and what the law should be. Yeah. And I want to add to that a thread that I think keeps coming up, which is that of the relationship between structures and the production of different kinds of rules. So in this context, and this again calls back to the keynote yesterday, is the question of why should the law be what it is. And so I ask the question of why, because if we think about sampling, if we think about hip hop and rap, a lot of that is a structural outcome of the way that the post-civil rights movement goes, or the post-civil rights era works out in the United States. So when you talk about intentional segregation, when you talk about urban crime, what you're talking about are people with a particular set of creative means of production. And so if that is the case, what does it mean that courts are not willing to consider that? What does it mean that courts are not willing to think about what the availability of resources is to different kinds of individuals? It seems to me to be very different to have someone like Ice-T sampling than it might be to have someone else. I might give the example of the Beastie Boys. They might not be the best example, but we can think about counterexamples along the lines of race, class, even gender potentially, and think about what it means for, say, Robin Thicke to engage in the kind of creative production that he does and without erasing Pharrell, and then think about that vis-a-vis Motown. So I think there's a lot of structural questions here about what sorts of resources individual artists have and how that pushes back against certain kinds of structures and the individuals that have control in those structures. So one of the things that I talk about in the book that I think is really interesting is how hip-hop and rap artists push back against the notion of the mafia and kind of reappropriate that idea of the mafia. So what does that mean if we think about that structurally? And how might we map that on to this song and sound production question that we're talking about?
Yeah, it's interesting that this, I think, I agree with your assertion, Anjali, that people of color are disenfranchised by copyright law mechanisms, but for different reasons. Because I think this is about admin. Essentially, you have a bunch of creators in the music industry. Any pop record has always been a team effort. You always have musicians and producers and songwriters, performers working together to make that collectively created product. And we have chosen, through the early 20th century, mostly through European and US copyright law that began in the early 20th century and was modified in the later 20th century, to reward the owner of the sound recording differently from we reward the owner of the composition. That obviously requires us to define what we mean by composition, hence my obsession with this question of what is a song, what do we mean by a song. I think the challenge is that there are whole genres of music that do not fit into that convenient paradigm of the sheet music's over here and the record's over here. It kind of fits Tin Pan Alley, and it fits the first half of the 20th century of the way that we made popular music, that the songwriter would literally write the song onto melody with stave through the music publishing industry, and the artist, usually a separate person, would record it. One of the things I like to do is collect old sheet music, and what I find fascinating is that through the early 20th century, in the very early 20th century sheet music, the songwriter was the photo on the cover of the sheet music. And then as radio came in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, you start seeing like Bing Crosby or Doris Day on the cover because they were the person that had the record out. But for purely administrative reasons, well, let's give everyone the benefit of the doubt and assume that it was for purely administrative reasons. The industry needed a mechanism by which you could pay the people who made the sound recording and you could pay the songwriters. And who can disagree that all of those creators should be compensated for their work? Problem is that there are a few genres of music, and perhaps not coincidentally, they are all black genres of music, where that model doesn't fit. The idea of the genius composer puts it down on paper and the recording engineer puts a microphone in front of some performers. So the first example is jazz. So I was talking with some friends over lunch about this. If you're Miles Davis and you do a cover of a Cole Porter song, doesn't matter how awesome your Miles Davis solos are, it's Cole Porter that gets the royalties because that's a cover version, a compulsory license in the music industry. And however creative you are, you're not compensated for that amazing Miles Davis solo. And yet, if you buy a Miles Davis record, you're not buying it because you like Cole Porter. You're buying it because you like Miles Davis. And the second example, and I think it's really important that Anjali brought this up, is hip-hop. Hip-hop is a straight-to-audio recording genre of music. There is no sheet music stage. You don't create pitches in time as part of the creative process. Relatedly, dancehall and rhythms that came out of Jamaica in the 60s, the idea is that you would have the same riff and you would reuse it and lots of different people would come in and sing over those elements. So the point is that all of these three genres, dancehall, jazz, and hip-hop, require you to borrow someone else's work and then transform it in some way. But you do it straight to the audio. There isn't that intermediate sheet music stage, which means administratively, I think the music publisher kind of doesn't have anything to go on. So for me, the answer, and people often say, you know, what should the law be? I really don't know. But the answer lies in reconfiguring the admin.
So I think that's the same point, really. It's not a legal question. You know, the convention that arrangements or improvisations are treated as cover versions with 100% of royalties going to the publisher. That's, you know, it's in fact wrong in law. You know, it's quite clear that you know that there's a independent composition by Miles Davis. Okay, you could argue, you know, they used another composition, but how that is distributed is an institutional and organizational arrangement. And what interests me is why do we persist? And I think some of your analysis is very, very pertinent there. You know, why do we persist with this? Which is, you know, there's no basis in law. It produces perverse results. Why do we persist?
So my answer, of course, would be that none of this is coincidental, that sound recordings aren't protected till the 1970s, and that is really, and I think you point this out, that's really about the impetus of who actually already had power before, right? So I think it's about corporate interests. I don't think that's about the interests of artists, at least not white artists at least not artists of color. So part of what you're talking about in terms of administration is about structural disenfranchisement. It's about the history of disenfranchising, particularly Black Americans and them not having access to reading and writing and not being able to record music, record it in writing, right? So if you can't write sheet music, you produce music. But there was very little incentive, and we know this from the history of race records and from the 1920s on, there was very little incentive for protecting that music. And I think what you end up with, and I like this idea of mafia capitalism because I think it gets at this, what you end up with is a concentrated power in the hands of corporations, of musical producers, and so on, but also contractual power. So there's a kind of contractual power that rests with largely white producers and white corporations, I'll say, that we can trace all the way to the present day. So Ravi Sundararajan talks about how the thing about mafia capitalism is that you pay the mafia to be protected from the mafia. And hip-hop is a really interesting example of that, because there's this pushback against what seems to be a centralized set of ownership rules. And what ends up happening is all these licensing requirements that essentially require artists to pay the people that are producing the music. So I think that's not coincidental at all.
There is one potential, in my legal dream world, in my law fantasy, there is one potential answer that I think is available to us. And I'm just going to talk very briefly about compulsory licensing. If anyone in this room wants to do a cover version of, make a song at random, John Lennon's Imagine, right? You can go home, you can get an Apple Mac and a microphone, and you can put that on top of your piano, and you can make that recording. You can release it on the internet, you can get it on Spotify, and as the owner of the sound recording, you can get a small amount of royalties for that. The publishing royalties will go back to John Lennon as the songwriter and his publishers. And that's called a compulsory license. My point is, you don't need to ask for John Lennon's publisher's permission to do that. It's a compulsory license. It's in European and US copyright law. So what if there were a compulsory license for samples? What if you could just use anything as audio? And you could just drop it into your track using software like Ableton Live or Pro Tools, Logic Pro, and you could just release it. And we already have sophisticated YouTube algorithms that can detect what is actually in an audio file. And it's not beyond the wit of the maths of the music industry to be able to figure out, okay, you've used 12 seconds of Gilbert O'Sullivan in that track, and therefore his publisher is owed 7.3% of your micropayment royalties. I think there is a potential way through there. What it doesn't solve the problem with jazz, because the idea of a transformative work through improvisation, I don't know how you get to that problem. But the problem of sampling, to me, seems that compulsory licensing would be a step in the right direction.
But you would give an incentive against using samples, isn't it?
Just as there is now, and people still use
exactly.
samples.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's fundamentally wrong. I mean, if it's used as a reference, why should we deprive our creative expression, you know, from making references to our contemporary culture? I think it's absurd.
Well, yeah. Which creator do you want to support? Applauders, because by that example, what about the owner of the original sample? Their work is being re-exploited, and they're not being compensated for that work. So. But there's creators at both ends of the chain. How do we decide whose work has more value?
No, I would completely agree. That's why you need to, you know, if it's an artistic expression, if it's a proper contextualized reference, you know, who are we to judge?
Right.
Who are we to judge? So I think that's the danger. You know, we make as lawyers or as the arbiter of something we shouldn't be. So I think it's I mean, that was the puzzle in a way I ended on is, you know, why do we are in a situation where the default is every single link touch of a abstract work needs to be licensed? You know, why are we in this world where we kind of given up on unlicensed use? Why do we need to seek for permission for what we do if we do it in the appropriate cultural context of our disciplines, of our society, of our you know, artistic creation? I think we have moved to a stage, you know, I think to a world where this assumption is shared. And I think it's absurd.
Well, it's a powerful societal and moral argument, but you still have to come down one side or the other on the admin. You know, if a playing of a track through YouTube generates ad revenue, that money's going to go to someone. Mm. And if that track is a mashup of one person's samples and another person's samples, and that's why it has cultural value, then we need to make a societal decision of which creator is rewarded. There's no question that the sample has value, otherwise people wouldn't use it. There's no question that the use is transformative, otherwise it wouldn't be a creative work. So I don't have the answer, I only have the question.
I wouldn't disagree.
I would bring us back to the question of transformativeness, because I actually think it's a really interesting question that ends up being a bit of a double standard. And the pendulum swinging back to accepting sampling or more liberal cases about sampling that we discussed on the first day, I'm going to bracket that for the moment. But when you look at cases like the one involving Two Live Crew, transformativeness is so narrow. The court has a really narrow understanding of what it means to create a new and original expression. And Siva Vedanathan talks about this in the film Copyright Criminals. He essentially says that courts were not interested in thinking about black artists' creative processes. So what is transformativeness? Where does it come from? What does it mean? Those are also really important questions. Because if you ask me, Biz Markie is not doing at all the same thing that Gilbert O'Sullivan is. And I would be very interested to know what the crossover audience is for those two pieces of music, other than copyright scholars, right? I don't think it's very big.
It's a good point. And, you know, that's quite a meta question that I ask myself about blurred lines. It's like, let's say that the jury's verdict was right, just for a moment. I don't take that view myself, but let's say that the jury's verdict was right and Sick and Pharrell copied from Marvin Gaye. Did the sales of Blurred Lines hurt the sales of Marvin Gaye's back catalogue? I suggest they probably didn't. I suggest there's no human alive who thought, now that I've heard Blurred Lines, I'm going to stop buying Marvin Gaye records. Because it's very clearly transformative. So I'm a bit out of my depth because it's a legal question, not a musical one. But you know, it seems to me from the economic point of view, who was harmed by Blurred Lines' alleged infringement?
I think it probably helped Marvin Gaye's estate. I think more people are listening to that song than they have in a very long time.
He's got 0.0009 cents from me today because I played it on Spotify.
So I've got another question on that. So a lot of the cases we looked at, one of the big five publishers is the target, and the claimant is an estate, okay? It's not the artist, it's the heirs. So do we have a view on this?
Yeah, just on the technicalities, I assume a lot of people in this room know this, but for most of the world, the life of copyright is the life of the creator plus 70 years, enabling the heirs to inherit the copyrights and profit. So, and it's when you compare that to patent law, where patents expire, is it 15 years, I think? 20 years in patent law. It's much, much shorter. So it's an interesting question, you know, how long should, in our case, in our examples, a musical work survive. You know, there are different points of view on it, which is, you know, the copyright should expire immediately, or after a few months, or after a few years, or never. I don't know.
So I'm very interested in tracing sentimentality and nostalgia as a way that estates tend to win, because I do think that a lot of the times when we talk about music, we're talking about what our emotional attachments are to particular kinds of music. So lots of people have lots of emotional attachments to Motown, and also the kind of music that Marvin Gaye was producing at that moment in the midst of all sorts of rights-related battles in the United States. I think you can't separate those questions from the why and how of who wins those cases. And of course, I would say copyright's too long.
Well, yeah, and given that pretty much Got to Give It Up and the Gilbert O'Sullivan tune, the name of which escapes me for a moment, were basically within 2 or 3 years of each other. And yet, I bet there's a lot more pop music fans in this room that romanticize Marvin Gaye than romanticize Gilbert O'Sullivan, just because he was a mainstream artist. You know, here's an experiment I did actually, just amused me anyway, a bit of trolling of my academic colleagues. I looked at the journal of my field, which is of the Association of the International Association for the Study of Popular Music, and I took three contemporary artists from the 70s, the Sex Pistols, the Carpenters, and the Osmonds, who were all releasing records at about the same time, kind of early, mid-70s, and I counted up the number of records they'd released and the number of column inches written about them by academics. And of course, lots of column inches were written about the Sex Pistols, who only ever released one album, and the Carpenters with their 31 singles, and the Osmonds with their whatever it was, 14 albums, were much less written about. And I think there is this interesting historicity around what we as academics do, and maybe what the market does. I think you're absolutely right. We romanticize cool artists for lots of socio-cultural reasons, and we ignore their cultural importance at the time, perhaps.
Should we take a question from the audience? Does anyone have a question? There's one in the back.
Hi, everyone. I feel bad taking the mic when I'm going to have it later, but I was curious because this is all fascinating and really useful to think with, so thank you all. But I was curious about, because this is title of this talk is on musical appropriation and business, everyone is talking from the point of view sort of, you know, there's money being generated and where should it go is one of the sort of presumptions. But really, that when you're talking especially about artists and also when you're talking about race and disenfranchisement, there's actually a question about, is copyright the right tool for fostering sort of economic comfort or beyond economic comfort, right? The access to the means of life. Because especially given the history of it starting as an industrial function, right? You know, what we're talking about sometimes is people's right to be credited or people's right to be known and recognized. And sometimes we're saying, oh, people need to make a living. I'm actually unsure that copyright is well suited to ensure people make a living. And I think we could ask that question about many jobs, right? Are people getting paid enough? Is that really the question? So I'm wondering how much, or in what way you think copyright is actually capable of fostering creative practices, or do we have to think about other things, like reparations, like just straight up redistributing resources to people who need them, not on the basis of whether their records sell or not, or something like that. I know this has gone quite meta, but I figure big questions, we'll start it off.
I'm on board for all of that. I think there's a lot of people doing really interesting research about what those alternative models might look like. So from Jane Anderson's work about indigenous peoples and licenses to work about Indian artisans and how we might protect local kinds of traditional knowledge. Reparations, I think, are important. I think that's maybe a slightly different conversation than alternatives to copyright, but it's a question that comes up, I think, often when people talk about blurred lines. And when I had this conversation with my class, part of the class was very convinced that this was kind of a reparative, like, making up for past injustices moment. I am not against that as a way of evening out the playing field, but one of the things that I think points to what you're saying, that copyright doesn't get the job done, and one of the reasons that I say that the question is not more copyright, but different copyright, if we read that case and all of its investments, is that Marvin Gaye's estate gets that money. Nobody else sees that money, right? No other artists see that money. It's not necessarily a precedent for those cases. So I think what we're talking about with copyright is a particularly Euro-American model of understanding knowledge. And I think thinking about all sorts of pushback to that, whether it is in the context of monetary compensation or new systems of knowledge ownership, is really important.
Yeah, I mean, as a lawyer, we obviously a difficult position there because the international framework is, you know, is so prescriptive, and it's very hard to move out of it. From first principles, you know, the first thing we should do is separate the investor perspective from the creator perspective. And I think, you know, any reasonable academic analysis has held this for a very long time. As an incentive for investing in these kind of products, you know, we don't need more incentives than patent law. I mean, it seems absurd that we need more incentives, you know, to create a song than you know, producing, you know, a new molecule. So I think nobody can disagree with that reasonably. The question is, you know, how do we do this within the framework we've been given? And I think there's probably a justification of rewarding creators, you know, during their lifetime in some ways. And there may be mechanisms by which you can use the international framework, you know, with reverting rights to them or compulsory collective administration. There may be some mechanisms you can devise, you know, to make the system more reasonable within the framework we've been given. But is that how societies change? You know, do they change by you know, kind of reasonable redesigns by a group of lawyers? I don't think they do. They change because, you know, fundamentally political economy in a society changes, or because I assume there's disobedience. There are other mechanisms which are more likely to happen, and so I wouldn't want to predict how it's going.
Well, I love how meta the question is, because this speaks right to the heart of how we might define, in the case of what we're talking about today, popular music societally. What I love about popular music, and I've studied it and played it all my adult life, is that it exists entirely within naked capitalism. It is defined. You know, why are songs 4 minutes long and not 9 minutes long? It's because there's more of a market for 4 minute songs. Why are they 4/4 time and not 7/4 time? Why do they stay in one key? Why do they have repeating choruses and 4-bar structures and songs about love in the lyric content? It's because this is what the market requires. And in a quasi-Darwinistic way, as I argue in all my academic writings on this, songs that don't meet those thresholds of market standards get filtered out. And over time, that, in a, I suggested, evolutionary way, defines what we mean by a popular song. So it's a constrained art form because that's what market forces require. But within that, those constrained boxes, we have great beauty and great wonderful records that we all love. But while we're just staying with the meta, I love the also the semantics of the term copyright. It's the right to make a copy. What do you do when that Mac sitting up there, the moment I click on Spotify and pull down, or iTunes, and pull down a file from a file server, it implicitly, well, it explicitly makes a copy on the local hard drive of that machine. Therefore, there is no copyright if everyone owns a copying machine everywhere they go. That's all of our phones, all of our devices, and so on. So, in a way, it started with the end of CDs. When you remove scarcity from the supply chain, or put another way, as a colleague of mine has in the title of his lecture, what do you do when the price of music approaches zero, and then there's no money to, there's no point in monetizing copyright? That's kind of where we are with Spotify and YouTube right now. So, yeah, I think it's an important point. Maybe copyright is the wrong tool in this cross-monetization economy we find ourselves in, when everyone's walking around with a digital copying machine.
I would add just very quickly that we're talking a lot about protectability, but we're not talking about the flip side of that, which is the public domain. So who gets to define the public domain, what's in it, what sorts of things are ripe for taking, and what implications does that have? Because I think that's also the kind of important double mirror question of what we're talking about, that suggests that we need something other than copyright, or at least dramatically different standards.
bend the record for a minute. It's actually a pretty common misperception that copyright is named after the verb to copy, but historically it's actually named after the noun copy, which was the common parlance to describe a piece of printed matter back when the concept of copyright was first termed. And only retroactively have we come to see it as referring to the verb of copying.
That's a really good point, yeah, absolutely.
Martin, do you want to?
Yeah, no, I think that means...
I guess we can agree whether noun or verb, it's a right. It is somebody's right.
I think we have time for one more question, if there is one.
Shall we hear a bit of Blurred Lines to finish, then?
Seems entirely appropriate.
Can't bear the idea of not, of talking about a piece of music and not playing it. It feels all wrong. So I think everyone here knows the background, but just for those who don't, 1977 got to Give It Up, the Marvin Gaye tune, Blurred Lines 2013. The jury in the initial case, I think 2014, found copying and substantial similarity. And let's listen to, this is the sheet music that appeared, was filed with the US Copyright Office. This is a transcription and it was done after the fact. So this is not Marvin Gaye's handwriting, this is a junior transcriber from the US Copyright Office. And so what you are going to see as you hear the track is those first two lines of music that I hope you can make out, which is the bass line, and then you're going to hear the falsetto melody. And as you hear it, try and get that melody in your head and then decide how much of it you think Robin Thicke has copied. There's the party noises. Listen to that cowbell. Okay, take it away, Robin.
Everybody get up.
This song has more cowbell. Go out to parties and sit at the center. But I was too nervous. I'm not getting it.
Okay, now he was close. Try to domestic.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I think the next panel is coming right after, or a 5 minutes break. 3 minutes break.